Kyle Freeland's re-implementing a hitch in his delivery. Evan Justice throws heat, but it spins a lot. And Brenton Doyle is speeding his way to a gold glove. Welcome to Adjusting for Altitude, a Colorado Rockies podcast analyzing the unique challenges faced by the only MLB team that plays a mile above sea level.
Baseball is a difficult game. The average hitter gets on base in less than 40% of their plate appearances. Yet the average pitcher gives up 4 runs every 9 innings pitched. The sport is a challenge on its own. But in altitude, the problems for baseball players compound. Less break on pitches, balls that fly significantly farther than at sea level, and then after playing in such a treacherous environment, the players play in normality for half of their regular season. Adjustments must be made by those who don the purple pinstripes of the Colorado Rockies. We discuss those adjustments here. This is Adjusting for Altitude with baseball fanatic and aspiring MLB general manager, Christopher Nelson II.
If you're new to this channel and or podcast, welcome. I'm very glad you're here. Uploads occur every Saturday. Adjusting for Altitude can be found on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, really anywhere across the World Wide Web. I'm your host, Christopher Nelson II, and you can go follow me on Instagram and X at IamTheSecond. You can also reach out to me via email at adjustingforaltitude@gmail.com if you'd rather communicate with me that way. Ladies and gentlemen, I am back. I know it's been way too long. It's been like a month and a half, 2 months or something like that. I'm so sorry. I've been away for such a long period of time. Who'd have thunk that being a 20-year-old grad student who's working full-time could be so complicated and time-consuming? But I ended up working out time in my schedule to come back and be with you all talking about the unique difficulties faced by the Colorado Rockies. And it recently occurred to me that we've never really done an intro to this podcast or on the YouTube or really anywhere in any content that we've ever done. So some of you might be wondering, because some of you might be new listeners or viewers to this show and this channel, what is Adjusting for Altitude? Why is it any different than any other Colorado Rockies content that I can find on the World Wide Web? Well, for starters, let's just talk about the issue of playing baseball in Colorado, or at altitude for that matter, 5,280 feet. That's about right. I've been a Colorado native my entire life, so I should know that off the top of my brain. 5,280, that's what Colorado's known for, being a mile above sea level. That's in Denver, at least. Other parts of the state are a little bit higher and a little bit lower based on where you go. But generally, the consensus about playing baseball in Colorado is not hard to find. You can find it pretty much anywhere within certain realms of the baseball world in certain conversations. It's not mainstream because the Colorado Rockies are not a good organization at this moment in time. But if you've ever heard people converse about playing baseball at altitude in Colorado, at Coors Field, common terminology and common concepts that you'll hear tossed around a lot include things like, oh, the ball travels farther here, the breaking balls break less, or leaving Coors Field as a player who plays half their season at Coors Field is an absolutely insurmountable challenge. Effectively, our philosophy on this podcast, and by our, I mean mine, and anyone who kind of supports the ideas that I'm getting at here on this podcast, our philosophy is a little bit different. You see, we would say that it's not necessarily the hard-hit deep fly balls that kill pitchers here in Colorado. It's more so the bloops and the softly hit balls that drop into the massive outfield that is Coors Field here. That's a much bigger threat because with more runners on base, all of a sudden those bigger hard-hit balls start to do a little bit more damage. We'd say that it's not the breaking balls that break less, although that is true here in Colorado, but it's actually the fastballs and the fact that the fastballs move less in an intended way that a lot of modern pitchers try to get them to move in. They don't rise here as much as they do elsewhere. And the difference between fastball movement at altitude and away from altitude is actually a lot more impactful than it is on most breaking balls. Funny enough, in fact, sliders move pretty much the same at altitude and away from altitude, within like an inch worth of difference, not even. It's like 0.6 inches. It's not a ton. We would also say that leaving Coors Field shouldn't really be an insurmountable challenge, and that the Rockies can actually experience long-term success in the future that is sustained if they actually approach building this organization from the minor leagues on up to the major league club with the right approach, and an approach that adjusts for all the different factors that, well, pretty much fall into the first two of those categories that we mentioned. So that's kind of our philosophy on adjusting for altitude here. It's not necessarily a show that's intended to debunk sort of the mainstream thoughts about playing baseball at altitude, although we do end up doing that nonetheless quite frequently. So you'll probably be entertained by that if that's sort of the things you like to get out of baseball podcasts, kind of debunking theories and such. That's not our main goal, although we end up doing it. We're more so trying to analyze the current state of the roster today, see what guys can play into the future success of this organization if they are actually to compete in the long term consistently, and what guys the organization needs to move away from, whether they have value or if they don't. They need to figure out what to do with guys like that. But on the redone version of this podcast, where we're kind of just moving towards a more centric, no live stream, straight content type of flow, I figured I'd give you kind of my own analysis of this organization. Now, I am an MBA student, like I said a little bit earlier, so I'm going to present this in sort of an MBA type of way. I'm sure many of y'all have heard of a SWOT analysis in your schooling, in whatever capacity that has been in thus far in your life. So SWOT analysis is pretty much just an assessment of the strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats that an organization has. And it's no different in Major League Baseball, so we're going to do the same thing with this team. We're going to talk about this once a week, just kind of get a gist for how things are flowing in regards to those four categories and what the overall objective of the organization seems to be at this moment in time. And we can actually just start there if we wanted to. The organization currently has a very obvious objective. They finally bought into the idea of rebuilding this franchise. Now, many fans, for a decent period of time, many Rockies fans that is, have been calling for the team to just accept the rebuild, accept the fact that they are not going to compete, especially not in an NL West that has the Dodgers and the Padres and the Diamondbacks, although the Padres have obviously underachieved thus far in 2023, probably not going to make the postseason. You already know that that team is stacked with names that on paper should be performing better than they have. Add in the Giants, who somehow find themselves in the playoff picture pretty much every season, and the Rockies are left at the bottom of that pile, not really expected to do very much in that stacked division. So over the last few years, despite the fact that they're not really expected to compete or prepared to compete within the division, they've still tried. They've tried. They've strived to build a team that, as Dick Monfort, the Rockies owner, has said, as recently as this offseason, build a team that can play 500 baseball. Now, they thought this year's team was a 500 baseball team. Unfortunately, they weren't. Earlier in the year, we made a podcast where we did our best to try and justify how maybe they could be a 500 baseball team if everything fell in place the way it needed to. Obviously not on pace for that. In fact, they're on pace for their worst season in franchise history. So it hasn't been good. But at least they've accepted the rebuild. They traded away pretty much every piece of value that they had at the deadline that needed to go. Guys like Pierce Johnson, Brad Hand, CJ Krohn, Randall Grichuk, etc. And they just fully adopted the idea that this is a season where they need to figure out what they have in-house so they can get a better picture going forward into the future. In terms of the team's strengths at the moment, one that's kind of caught my eye over the last week or so has been the defense of all things. Now, I know we've kind of been spoiled as Rockies fans, having guys like Troy Tulowitzki, Trevor Story, Nolan Arenado, guys who play gold glove caliber defense at their positions, roaming around our infield, even in our outfield. Cargo was a pretty solid defender over the course of his career. You had a guy like Gerardo Parra here for a few years. Defense has been an important aspect of the Rockies brand pretty much over their entire existence, to some extent. And it's going to need to continue to be that way, obviously, with the challenges presented at Coors Field. They need guys who can run around the outfield and get fly balls, a topic we're going to dive into in a little bit more detail with one of the guys we're talking about on today's episode. But guys that can run around the outfield, get fly balls, guys that can parole on the infield and make plays for their pitchers when ground balls are induced, those are important. And recently, it feels like the defense is, at a minimum, underrated. Guys like Ezekiel Tovar, Nolan Jones, Brenton Doyle are playing exceptional defense. Now, I kind of spoiled it with the mentioning of Doyle, but guys like Tovar and Jones, guys like that who are so young and yet are playing really, really solid defense, even in the case of a guy like Tovar, who's one of the best defensive shortstops in the league by metrics and even by eye test for that matter. It's great to see that those guys are starting to come into their own and take advantage of the opportunities that they've been given. Not only offensively, the offense will come. Those guys are talented hitters. But the fact that they're not afraid to make defensive plays where they lay out and put their body on the line or make leaping catches in the outfield after running a long ways. Stuff like that is going to be really, really critical for this team. And it's also going to be critical for guys like maybe a Ryan McMahon who don't always bring the stick to the yard and hit on a consistent basis. But at the same time, play top tier defense. I think Ryan's like second in the league in DRS for third baseman. So defense has been a strength that's been on display in recent weeks for this ball club. One of the weaknesses that has popped up, however, is the bullpen. Now, if you'd asked me earlier in the year if you'd asked me the question, I guess, do you think that the starting rotation or the bullpen is more solid? Which one do you think it is? I would have easily picked the bullpen. The bullpen was by far the better of those two staffs, starting and relieving, earlier in the year. Unfortunately, after a lot of the key relievers were traded away, guys like Pierce Johnson and Brad Hand, after guys like Brent Suter spent time on the injured list as well, it's been tough. It's been tough for the bullpen. Justin Lawrence's growing pains have also started to come through in recent weeks as well. He hasn't had the best of luck in those eighth and ninth inning situations that he's been placed in. And it's been overall unfortunate. Now, that's not to say that there's not hope. It's just a current weakness that this organization has had in recent games, in recent weeks. And is it a promising sign? Are there any promising signs, rather? There are a few. But again, I'm not entirely convinced that this organization has the right mindset on what guys need to be in what roles and what guys need to be on this team in general. So overall, the bullpen is a weakness given the current agenda that the Rockies front office kind of has demonstrated about how they want to build this team and their pitching staff. I'm not super encouraged. But again, you have guys like Lawrence who are still very young and have overall demonstrated a much better ability to perform overall this season as they have as compared to previous seasons. So there is potential for younger guys like Lawrence. Nick Mears has shown flashes. Matt Cook has shown flashes. That was a sneaky good signing that they made in the offseason. So it's guys like that that give me some hope for this team. In terms of opportunities, I kind of mentioned it a little bit earlier. They need to see what the future looks like. They need to see what they have in-house, and good on them. Good on them for getting that process started. They promoted guys like Hunter Goodman, who have already shown that they can swing it at the major league level. He's also been pretty solid defensively, mostly at first base. He's a subpar defender in right field based on what I've seen thus far. It makes sense. He's a bigger guy. He's not going to be out there making sprinting, diving, layout kind of catches or hosing people at the plate in right field. That's just not his build. Even as a catcher, it's never been his build. He used to be a catcher primarily, and then he shifted more towards first base because defensively he was not a very good catcher. But he can swing the twig, and he, I think, has a solid role at first base going forward for the Colorado Rockies. He'll at a minimum be in that mix, obviously, with guys like Ellerice Montero and Michael Tolia. Ellerice has also shown flashes, another younger guy who struggled earlier in the year and got sent down to AAA. But came back. He struggled even after getting recalled the several times he has been recalled this season. But overall, in recent games, he's started to show some discipline at the dish, which has been promising. Michael Tolia still has some development to do. I thought he'd be in the first base picture a lot more than he's kind of put himself in that position so far this season as the season has gone along. So I think he still has some AAA stuff that he needs to work out before he does get an opportunity over guys like Ellerice and now Hunter Goodman at the major league level. But that's probably the most notable one that I've seen in recent games that I've noticed, at least. Guys like Elias Diaz and Austin Wins are holding down the catching position for now. There are catching prospects on the way that could contribute as soon as 2024, likely 2025. I'm particularly talking Drew Romo, a guy who possesses solid offensive potential but is mostly known for his defense. It'll be interesting to see how guys like that begin to develop as they enter AA and AAA and might get a chance with the big club within the next year or two. But in terms of that, I think the outfield is pretty set for the Rockies. It looks like you're going to have an outfield that consists of Nolan Jones, Brenton Doyle, and then maybe a guy like Yankiel Fernandez or Zach Veen, who are on the way within the next few years. Overall, the in-house products seem to be solid in terms of position players. Now, we're yet to see what the pitching side of that looks like. Obviously, the Rockies invested heavily in pitching in this year's draft. The solid majority of their picks were pitchers. And all college. They didn't take any pitchers from high school in 2023. So it'll be interesting to see how fast some of those guys work through the system. There's a wide variety of starters, relievers, closers. It'll be interesting to see how they develop. Obviously, the Rockies minor league system isn't necessarily set up to develop them optimally to perform at Coors Field, seeing as only one minor league affiliate plays at a decently high altitude, and that is AAA, which also plays in the PCL, which is just known for being a hard league to pitch in general. So it'll be tough for some of those guys to pan out in Colorado Rockies uniforms. Aside from that, I like the fact that they're seeing what they have in-house and working inward out as they start to begin to figure out how this organization needs to move forward in things like free agency and filling in the holes that they need to. And then lastly, in terms of threats, the only threat that the Rockies possess that I've realized in the last few weeks or so in analyzing this team is themselves. Quite honestly, their largest threat is the front office themselves. The front office has so much power to do so much with this team. They're so good at drafting and developing hitters. It's not funny. Like, they're just great. MLB thanks the Colorado Rockies for developing guys who can hit the baseball. Unfortunately, they haven't realized that the approach they're taking to drafting pitchers is not panning out the same way for a very obvious reason. They're drafting guys who simply don't fit the mold of guys who can succeed at Coors Field in the long term. In the long term, am I saying that they're not going to show flashes at Coors Field, those pitchers that aren't built to succeed here? Of course they're going to show flashes. They're good pitchers. And we're actually going to get into one of these guys on this podcast episode today, so you'll get a better understanding of what I'm talking about. But overall, in the long term, we're talking over multiple years, consistency. They're not going to find it easy to develop that consistency simply because their pitch builds do not allow for them to be very consistent between Coors Field and away from Coors Field in a quite extreme manner. So really the largest threat is the front office. They need to draft pitchers better. They need to revolutionize their pitch drafting strategy and realize that the circumstances that plague Coors Field are not going to plague them as much, or those players as much, as if they were drafted by other organizations, meaning guys that have high spin rate fastballs and high spin rate curveballs, pitches that don't work at Coors Field as well as they do elsewhere, are not going to pan out well here, at least not in the long term on a consistent basis. All right, so it's time for the bread and butter of this podcast, where we talk about a few players in a little bit of depth. We talk about some sabermetrics and some statistics behind their contributions, and we just kind of assess where they're at this point in time. Now, the first player I want to talk about on today's episode is Kyle Freeland.
Player number one.
Now, in order to start this conversation about Kyle, I want to take us back just a little bit to 2017, Kyle's rookie season. And I very, very vividly remember opening day. It was like early April 2017. The Dodgers were in town at Coors Field. I was in school. I was just a wee young high schooler. And I remember we won that game 2-1. But the most important thing that I remembered about that game was the fact that we had a rookie starter on the mound who was a left-handed pitcher and had a very Kershaw-like allure to his motion. And the fact that he had that a little pause at the top of his motion that kind of got you like, whoa, that's unique. That's different. It's cool. And I remember looking at that, watching the highlights later that day after school and thinking, wow, we have a baby Kershaw. That's what 14-year-old me kind of thought about seeing Kyle Freeland pitching in Rockies pinstripe purple. But I really didn't have any idea how good he could be. I wasn't super on top of the whole depth of the organization in terms of minor league prospects and who is expected to be good and who is expected to be not good or not pan out to be a top tier MLB player or pitcher, etc. So in 2018, the subsequent season, when Kyle finished fourth in NL Cy Young voting, on the best Rockies team that we'd had in very recent history, I was very pleasantly surprised. I was like, wow, okay, Kyle's great. He's fantastic. He had a 166 ERA plus, meaning he was 66 percentage points better than the league average pitcher in 2018. And he had a 3.67 FIP. FIP is pretty much just a dictator that tells you how good a pitcher is, independent of circumstantial outcomes that occur in their game that they don't really have control over. So overall, 2018 Kyle Freeland, good pitcher, not circumstantially dependent. I was like, he's here. My baby Kershaw has arrived, and I was so excited. But he significantly regressed in 2019, and coaches thought that there was something very wrong with Kyle. They didn't really consider the fact that he was a third-year pitcher, and it happens that third-year pitchers, very young pitchers, tend to have regression and regressive seasons like this. It's not uncommon. And instead, in 2020, after Kyle's terrible season that was riddled by a few injuries and even resulted in him getting demoted to AAA, didn't matter. In 2020, Kyle had his motion changed. In fact, this is what Rockies pitching coach Daryl Scott, who was actually the bullpen coach at the time, said that they were working with Kyle on at that point in time over that offseason. He said, quote, "We are going to try and get rid of that pause at the top and create a little more rhythm with his delivery, which should in turn get him working down his line to the plate a little better." Now, he was very solid in the shortened 2020 season. He posted a 120 ERA plus, meaning he was an above average MLB pitcher, and a 4.65 FIP, which means he wasn't the greatest in terms of circumstantial outcomes, and he had a lot of things go his way that he didn't really have control over. But overall, you left the shortened 2020 season thinking that Kyle was back, kind of, maybe, potentially. Well, that was in 2020. Here we are 3 years later, and Kyle is actually worse now, substantially, than he was in 2020. And he's actually been trending worse since 2020, every single year. His ERA plus has continuously trended down. His FIP has continually hovered right above 4. And he's most certainly not back to being 2018 Kyle Freeland. Now, why is this? The change in his delivery was not the only change that the pitching coaching staff made to Kyle over that offseason. Funny enough, that's the one that's most notable, but there's some other stuff going on behind the scenes. First off, this is where Kyle is in 2023. He's 6-14 with a 5.09 ERA in 146.2 innings pitched. He has 91 strikeouts, 41 walks, a 5.36 FIP, a 1.47 WHIP, good for an ERA plus of 99. So he's actually below MLB average of 100 ERA plus. Now, from 2017 to 2019, Kyle's spin rate on his most used pitch, his four-seam fastball, was right around 2,270 RPMs, which was below MLB average at the time, I believe. If not, it was right around average. It's not terribly high, it's not terribly low, it's just kind of right in the middle. Now, in his rookie season in 2017, he had a better ERA at home in more innings pitched at home, and he had more walks and strikeouts and a better batting average against at home at Coors Field. Now, we're not going to overjudge a rookie's season, but, you know, it's a good sign that he can pitch successfully at Coors Field. Going into 2018, a very similar trend occurred. He had a better ERA at home in less innings pitched at home. And he had fewer walks and slightly fewer strikeouts and a better batting average against at home. Now, this is what his motion looked like in the windup in 2018.
Back of the cage, I said that's a hit in any league, except when you have the shift on.
That is correct.
Here's Turner, getting 10 for 17, and there's a strike right on the inside corner.
And this is what it looked like in the stretch.
A barber shop inside one of the vans. Guys can get, and gals can get their hair cut, get cleaned up, get a shower, get a fresh change of clothes, and anything else that they potentially need right there. And
now, if you're listening to this podcast on audio like Spotify, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, etc., unfortunately, you're missing out on these clips. So I really hope you enjoy just listening and imagining what these clips actually look like. If you want to drop by the YouTube and see what these clips look like and see what we're talking about, you should definitely do that. I highly encourage it. But nonetheless, in 2019, he pitched fewer innings. obviously, because, well, number one, he was hurt. He had an issue with his throwing hand, I believe, like a finger. And he also had a groin injury later in that season, on top of the fact that he was demoted sometime around May or June, I want to say, in 2019. Nonetheless, in 2019, he had a 2 times higher ERA at home. In fewer innings pitched, he had fewer walks, he had fewer strikeouts, and a worse batting average against at home. And this is what his motion looked like in the windup.
With Josh Bell and Freddie Freeman. Away to the right-hander with a fastball.
And this is what it looked like in the stretch.
Take strike one. Got a call right there, did Freeland.
Overall, nothing super out of the ordinary compared to 2018. He just had a regressive year. Now, going into 2020, delivery changes were made. His four-seam fastball spin rate also happened to increase during this offseason. Interesting. Kind of something that went under the radar of most. It wasn't just a small increase. It was an increase of 170 RPMs up to 2,440 rotations per minute on average. That's substantially higher than he had had in any of the previous seasons up to this point in time. It's also interesting to note that his four-seam fastball velocity also began to trend downwards after 2020. That's something you're going to want to keep an eye on with me as we continue talking about Kyle throughout the years. In 2020, in the shortened season, he only threw 70.2 innings that season. He had a worse ERA at home, in more innings pitched at home. He had fewer walks and fewer strikeouts and a worse batting average against at home. This is kind of what his motion looked like.
2017, top five in Cy Young voting the next year, ahead of Betts 0-2.
Now this is what his motion looked like out of the stretch.
So important here, I want you to
note that he averaged 92 miles per hour with his four-seam fastball in 2020. Now, here's the thing about an increase in fastball spin rate. An increase in fastball spin rate directly correlates to less perceived movement and even sort of a dropping effect at Coors Field. And while it's very generalized, I do think that it's fair to see that Freeland walked more and struck out more batters on the road in 2020, the first year he had that substantial spin rate increase, in fewer innings pitched, by the way, and say that the increased spin rate definitely contributed to his performance in the way that 2020 season in particular worked out. But going into 2021, we are going to see if the trend continued. In 2021, he had a worse ERA at home and only 1.1 fewer innings pitched at home. He had fewer walks, one more strikeout, and a worse batting average against at home. And this is what his motion looked like out of the windup.
Center.
And out of the stretch.
Ruff takes a strike.
He averaged 91 miles per hour of velocity on his four-seam fastball in 2021, a 1 mile per hour decrease from the prior year. Now in 2022, he had a worse ERA at home yet again, in only 0.2 fewer innings pitched. He had fewer walks, fewer strikeouts, and a worse batting average against at home, and this is what his motion looked like out of the windup. Out of the stretch.
Regularly, but he has to throw a strike. Make sure it's what you want to hit.
In 2022, Kyle averaged 90 miles per hour with his four-seam fastball. Again, another 1 mile per hour velocity drop. Now we're in 2023, and in 2023, he has a better ERA at home by 0.08, not substantially, in only 0.2 fewer innings pitched. He has more walks, he has significantly more strikeouts, and a better batting average against at home, although it's still really high at .293. This is what his motion looks like in the windup in 2023.
Where do you go?
I try to put it out of my mind as quick as I can.
Out of the stretch.
Second straight off day for Willie. There goes Weimer. Throw down to second base. And the tag is applied and out is the call.
Thing is, in 2023, Kyle is averaging 89 miles per hour on his four-seam fastball in terms of velocity. That is atrociously slow. and it's significantly down from where he was just 3 years prior. Overall, no, there's only a slight difference between 2022 and 2023 Kyle Freeland, but some recent trends in relation to his four-seam fastball spin rate and his delivery timing, most importantly, are very encouraging. For starters, his four-seam fastball spin rate has started to trend back down. It's decreased over the last 3 years. While it hasn't been substantially, it has definitely decreased from the 2440 mark that it was at in 2020 down to right around 2360 or 2380 that it is in 2023. Obviously an encouraging trend, although not terribly substantial. Now, he has also begun to implement a mild delay in his timing in recent starts. Now, if you'll go back to some of those 2023 clips that I just flashed a few seconds ago, it's kind of hard to tell to the untrained eye what I'm looking at, but if you time out his motion in your head and compare it to 2020, you'll start to see that it's just a tad bit more delayed and a little bit slower than it was back in 2020. Again, very encouraging. One of the reasons, I think, why his four-seam fastball velocity has increased recently as well. 92 miles per hour has been his max over the last week or so, in his last three or four starts even, going back that far. So it feels like he's even averaging 90 to 91 miles per hour on that pitch recently. Encouraging signs for sure, hands down. We like to see Kyle getting his velocity back. It means he's starting to get back to the pitcher who he was back in 2018. And I think we could very easily talk about the other aspects of his repertoire and what needs to change in order to contribute to him being successful in the long term, in the near future as well, such as his need to improve and throw his changeup more as opposed to his curveball, even though it seems like he likes his curveball more in recent years for whatever reason. It's not built to succeed at Coors Field as well as the changeup is. And the changeup was his third most used pitch back in 2018. Seems like a fairly straightforward investment to me. But nonetheless, aside from the rest of his repertoire, if Kyle can successfully re-implement a pause-like feature in his delivery and lower his fastball spin rate at the same time, his ability to deceive batters will significantly improve and his velocity will continue to increase and he'll be closer to his prime 2018 self as well. Now, Kyle Freeland needs to do himself justice by making the following changes to his game, but justice is already being served in the menu of the Colorado Rockies bullpen.
Player number two.
Evan Justice is a rookie left-handed reliever for the Colorado Rockies. Shout out to Rockies Roundup, who is the source for the summary that I'm about to give you of Mr. Justice. You should go follow that account on Instagram if you like regular Rockies content at Rockies Roundup. But Evan Justice was drafted in the fifth round of 2021. He's a funky southpaw who has a funky delivery with funky timing. Big velocity, 95, 96, 97 on the fastball, and he also throws a low 80 slider as well. And in the minors thus far in 2023, he has dropped some pretty decent numbers, to say the least. 63 strikeouts in 38 innings pitched across three minor league levels, Single-A Spokane, Double-A Hartford, and Triple-A Albuquerque. He surrendered a batting average against of 131, only one home run and 17 hits across those 38 innings pitched and across those levels. Now, it sounds solid off the bat, but I want us to take a look at something really quickly. He's been solid in Single-A Spokane, solid in Double-A Hartford, posting a 3.8 and 2.7 strikeout-to-walk ratio at those levels, respectively. He also posted a 125 and 096 batting average against, respectively, at Spokane and Hartford, with a solid 3.38 ERA at Hartford. Not the same story in AAA for Justice, though. Now, I want us to consider something before we get into the whole concept of Woods AAA. It's going to be harder. The altitude of Spokane, Washington, 1,843 feet. The altitude of Hartford, Connecticut, 30 feet. 30 feet! Pretty much sea level. The altitude of Albuquerque, New Mexico, 49, 67 feet. Now, I get that playing at AAA is significantly harder than playing at AA. Then I get that the PCL, the Pacific Coast League, is harder to pitch in than arguably any other minor league. I also get that AA is harder than Single-A. and that altitude impacts a pitcher's ability to pitch well. Justice's four-seam fastball averages 2,350 RPMs. It's a high spin rate for that pitch. It would be above MLB average for that pitch type. This is what it looks like at Coors Field.
Springer can run it first. And the first pitch is in there for a strike at 95.
And away from Coors Field.
This Friday night in San Francisco. Strike two.
Look, it's hard to tell a difference in either of those two. I get it. But if you'll notice, in the one at Coors Field, it kind of initially takes off on its plane, but it starts to flatten out a lot more than it does on the road. I get that there's some disparity in the camera angles as well, but for the most part, the statistics back that up. Pitches, like four-seam fastballs, rise less at Coors Field. Injustice, as a guy who throws an above-average spin rate fastball, will demonstrate this in the long term, whether you can notice it visually or not. However, am I saying that the increase in altitude and the impact that has on his spin rate from either AA to AAA or AAA now to the majors is the reason why his strikeouts to walk ratio is dropping in three fewer innings pitched, particularly between AA and AAA? Or is that the reason why his whip was effectively doubled from AA to AAA as well? Now, some of you might have been keen and noticed that the strikeout to walk ratio he's had this season at each level has steadily declined by literally 1.1 strikeouts to walk at every single level he's been promoted to. The only thing is, after the first promotion from single A to double A, he experienced the 1.1 strikeout to walk ratio drop in 6.1 more innings pitched. With the 1.1 strikeout to walk ratio drop from AA to AAA, he experienced it in three fewer innings pitched. Just something to take note of. Now, Justice is a strikeout pitcher, and he will get his strikeouts. Like we said, big southpaw lefty, he knows how to get his punchies. However, if he's in purple pinstripes, he's never going to get them consistently and frequently as he has to this point in career at pretty much every level he's pitched at. He's either going to go the route, likely, of Daniel Bard or Gavin Hallowell, respectively, either better on the road by ERA with more strikeouts and walks at home, or better at home by ERA with more walks and strikeouts on the road, just based on the inconsistency that having a high spin rate fastball brings to any major league pitcher. It's also worth noting that in this case, better is a very relative term. Better could very well mean that he has a 4 ERA at home and a 6 ERA on the road, or vice versa. Either way, it's not a good thing. So the inconsistency that's presented by such a high spin rate pitch, like a four-seam fastball, also works the same for curveballs, but Justice doesn't throw one, so we're not going to get into that issue. If you want to hear a little bit about that issue, go find the episode that I talked about Nick Mears. I get into that in a little bit more detail on that episode. Nonetheless, in terms of Coors Field and away from Coors Field, four-seam fastballs that are higher spin rate are impacted substantially by the altitude adjustment. If you don't like the Bard or Hallowell comparisons, ask Wade Davis, a guy who had forever pitched better at home than he had on the road until he put on purple pinstripes for the first time in 2018 and found out the hard way that pitching at Coors Field with a high spin rate fastball, the pitch you throw most of the time, is not going to bring you consistent success in the long term. People wonder why that didn't pan out. We might have to talk about that in a little bit more depth, in particular Wade Davis's case over the offseason or something like it. Nonetheless, what needs to change is very simple. Evan Justice needs to lower his fastball spin rate to right around 2200, 2250 RPMs on average if he wants greater consistency in the long term. The less reliant he is on the spin that his fastball produces, the more consistent in all regards he will be in any venue. Now, he's got the arm to make his consistency with the high spin rate that he's enjoyed to this point in his career translate. So he doesn't need as much spin as I think he thinks he needs. Check a guy like Josh Hader, a solid lefty, one of the best relievers in baseball, one of the best closers in baseball, for something similar. Very low spin rate fastball, but it's high velocity and he has a funky motion and he makes it work. That's the type of guy, that Evan Justice needs to be if he wants to be consistently successful in the Colorado Rockies' long-term plans. Now, again, the low spin rate slider is not a good thing, but it's also lower velocity, which counters his fastball fairly nicely. And again, the funky delivery doesn't hurt him either. But if he drops the spin rate and continues improving the rest of his game from a technical perspective, he's got good back end of the bullpen potential for the Rocks. And I do look forward to seeing that funky delivery in this bullpen in the long term, just with a few tweaks. Now, Evan Justice needs to strike some gold in the process of refining his pitch builds, but there's actually an outfielder on the Colorado Rockies team right now that needs some serious consideration for a gold glove.
Player number three.
Brenton Doyle might be the very definition of an MLB average player in the most extreme way possible, literally. By batting run value, he is in the third percentile of MLB with negative 17. By base running run value, he's in the 65th percentile of MLB with 1. But in terms of fielding run value, he is in the 100th percentile of MLB with 17. So literally, he is one of the worst hitters in MLB. He's a slightly above average base runner, and he's literally one of the best, if not the best, defensive outfielders in all of Major League Baseball. That is a crazy spectrum that Brenton finds himself on. Now, currently, Doyle is tied for second in MLB in center fielder DRS, which, for those of you who are unaware, stands for defensive runs saved. It's widely regarded as the most accurate metric in determining who the best defensive players are and the worst defensive players are, for that matter, at any given position. So Doyle is currently second in MLB center fielders. In DRS, he's tied with Kevin Kiermaier of the Toronto Blue Jays, who is up there with him at 14. But both are behind Dalton Varsho, who is at like 17, I think. And he's only played 427.1 innings in center field this season, which is kind of impressive compared to the 847 and 825.2 that Doyle and Kiermaier have played thus far, respectively. Doyle, however, is tied for 9th in MLB in outfield assists. A cumulative stat, by the way. Keep in mind, Doyle was called up a month into the MLB season. He was not on the opening day roster. He was called up in late April. And he's already top 10 in the entirety of MLB in outfield assists, throwing runners out at bases. Despite the fact that he's been poor offensively, like really poor from a consistency perspective, even though he's actually 62nd percentile in MLB in barrel rate, which is why I think there's some potential with the bat there. I'll get to that a little bit later. But he's been in the lineup effectively every day despite his offensive struggles. Why is that? Well, maybe it's because he keeps doing stuff like this.
This is in the left field, left center field for a base hit. And Arcia is coming home. The throw is in time. Out at the plate.
And this.
Josh Lowe's at the plate. He bats eighth in the lineup for Tampa, and he hits this ball straight away. Long run for Doyle, and he makes this play.
Even this, occasionally.
You love his chances at quickly ending up at second. Well, this ball is hit to deep center field. Did he click this one? You bet! He's done it again! To the rules! How about that pop? To the Falcons in center. The Rockies lead by two again.
Despite being in the lower percentiles of the league in terms of batting, expected weighted on base average, expected batting average, expected slugging, whiff rate, strikeout rate, walk rate, etc., Doyle is in the 99th percentile of outfielder range, also known as outs above average, the 99th percentile of arm value, the 99th percentile of sprint speed, the 98th percentile of arm strength, even recording the hardest thrown ball of the StatCast era literally like a week or so ago against the Braves. 106 miles per hour from the outfield. He didn't get anybody out. He just rifled a throw to home, and the Braves didn't send the runner who was at third, who could have been sent home, home. He would have been hosed by a mile. And see, Doyle is just, this is what separates Doyle from even guys like Varsho and Kiermaier, who are right around his level of defensive output in center field. Brenton's speed is speed that Varsho doesn't have. He's got an arm that Kevin Kiermaier doesn't have. Brenton Doyle gets around the outfield extremely well. He makes diving catches. He throws runners out, meaning he's also keeping runners from running also. So considering Coors Field is the largest outfield in Major League Baseball, the Rockies need rangy, speedy outfielders who also possess a cannon. That's not a bad thing. Literally, Brenton Doyle. See, I saw Brenton make a few swaggy defensive plays earlier in the season. He hit a few bombs. He led the team in steals fairly early in the season as well, almost at one point having as many steals as the rest of the team combined. And based on that, and the fact that he did that upon his initial call-up a few weeks into getting relatively regular playing time, I went out on this podcast and I made the prediction that he has superstar potential. Now, I'm sticking to that prediction, but we aren't going to go into any depth on the offensive aspect of Brenton's game on this episode, but if he keeps refining his approach at the plate and finds something that works for him, which I believe he can, he's been experimenting with lots of different things in terms of his hand positioning, in terms of his foot positioning, toe tap, leg kick, etc. So he's working on stuff. If he can find something that works for him, I think he can be a more than solid nine-hole hitter for this Rockies team over the next 5 to 10 years at a minimum. A guy who could potentially give you like a 250 batting average, 15 home runs, 30 stolen bases out of the everyday nine-hole. Like, many have begun to question recently his ability to hit at the major league level. It's been a question even since he came out of college, fun fact, and it's been a question throughout his minor league journey. But I really don't think it's going to be as big of a problem as people make it out to be in terms of the whole hitting thing. Obviously, we've seen he can smack baseballs. The home run that I just showed you went like 440 feet. He can smack baseballs. He has that ability. The barrel rate percentile ranking demonstrates that too. So I think with time, if you compare his defensive prowess, the fact that he's literally one of the best defenders in MLB as a rookie, to the fact that he's working on stuff offensively, I think you can put that together and get a picture of a guy who can be a solid center fielder for this team for the next 5 to 10 years. If he's on my Rockies team, then he better be on the actual Rockies team. Because if I'm seeing something in him, surely the team that drafted him and has made him their everyday center fielder to this point in time that is literally working on stuff with him sees something similar as well. This has been Adjusting for Altitude, a Colorado Rockies podcast. Look, we've covered a lot on today's episode, but if you've made it this far in the show, I do want to remind you that your listenership and or viewership is very much appreciated. On this show, you're listening to the unique thoughts and ideas of somebody who wants to work in the industry of MLB, eventually as a front office executive, and therefore seeks to provide you with the what and the why behind the advanced analytics, statistics, and sabermetrics of your favorite Colorado Rockies players. So I do hope you enjoy the depth and the perspectives that I share on this podcast. You can't find this level of depth anywhere else on the World Wide Web, especially in terms of MLB content, because MLB, at a very broad level, does not cover the Colorado Rockies very frequently because they're really not a very good organization at this moment in time. But if you did enjoy this episode, please share it with your friends, your family, or anyone else you think would enjoy listening to an analysis of the sabermetrics behind the unique challenges presented to the only MLB team that plays a mile above sea level. Until next week, I hope you have a great rest of your week. God bless, and go Rockies.